This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, this is Valerie Sanderson from the Global News Podcast. We're bringing you the latest on talks in Paris to discuss European security and an end to fighting in Ukraine. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning with European leaders as they gather in Paris at short notice and try to, well, it almost seems as if we're watching them try to regain their balance as the landscape shifts around them. It's partly about the fact that the US is pushing towards a rapid peace agreement with Russia on Ukraine, quite possibly without much input from Ukraine and certainly not from Europe. Russian and US officials are having their first face-to-face meeting in Saudi Arabia today. And the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, couldn't resist poking fun at the absent Europeans.
I don't know what they would be doing at the negotiating table. If they're going to concoct some cunning ideas about freezing the conflict, while really they mean continuing the war, then why invite them there?
A lack of formal European involvement in peace negotiations is seen as a big enough deal. But the leaders at this summit are also having to conjure, it seems, with immense questions about how Europe manages its security in the future. And perhaps to answer those questions in very short order. Well, those leaders have just turned up at the Elysee Palace and among them, the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. The UK has, Sir Keir said, expressed a conditional willingness to deploy troops to Ukraine. But he said that there had to be a permanent ceasefire agreed in order for Russia to be in a position never to invade in the future.
Unless and until we get a peace agreement, we must ensure Ukraine's in the strongest possible position. We don't know what's going to happen next. And we need to have realistic and credible answers to how any ceasefire, how any peace agreement will be lasting, just and enduring. Because the last thing I want to see is a pause in the fighting that simply gives Putin the chance to come again, which is why it's very important that we have these discussions. And I think it's very important for the UK to be talking, obviously, with our European allies, as we do the whole time, and to the US, got a special relationship. But I do think there's a huge amount of overlay in terms of what we're trying to achieve, which is that lasting peace and dealing with the threat that is there from Russia.
Well, as I mentioned, the summit's been summoned by the French President Emmanuel Macron, and our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding is there for us. What are these European leaders trying to achieve?
It's not clear for a start because there is no agenda. This is not a summit, as the French put it. This is an informal conversation or the beginning of a conversation. So French officials are very much playing down expectations despite having called this emergency summit. They're saying really that they're not expecting it to reach any resolutions. Rather, it's a chance for European leaders to reflect on what's been said so far by the Americans and also, I think, to prepare themselves for what may potentially come in the next few days if these negotiations, direct negotiations between the Russians and the Americans proceed, whether there are results of that, and for Europe to sort of gird its loins and prepare for what could be some big announcements in the coming weeks. This rapprochement between the Russians and the Americans has really caught everyone here by surprise. Not that they hadn't been briefed and understood that America was changing in its attitudes to Europe, but I don't think they expected quite the degree of speed and hostility from the White House that we've seen in the last few days. So there is an element today of Europe coming together to make a sort of political point that they should not, they must not be ignored or sidelined, and that Ukraine must not be. But also, I think they are looking in more concrete terms at what they can do if the ceasefire negotiations do bear fruit, and if the Kremlin and the White House can come up with a deal that Ukraine also is willing to sign up to. So they are looking, we understand, in fairly concrete terms about the possibility of a Europe-wide peacekeeping force. Some people talk of 50,000 soldiers, some of 100,000. They need to work out where those troops might come from, how they're funded and supplied. And above all, I think they want to stress that Europe alone cannot guarantee Ukraine's security, that fundamentally America still needs to be standing behind Europe within NATO and warding off the Russians.
Our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding. Fred Flights is the former deputy assistant to President Donald Trump and former chief of staff of the National Security Council. Earlier in the day, he described this meeting of European leaders as a temper tantrum. Why so?
Well, I understand that President Macron called an emergency summit because European officials would not be at this meeting between American and Russian leaders in Saudi Arabia. I don't think this is an emergency. I might note that U.S. officials have been meeting with European officials and Ukrainian officials for months. I think the issue here is that Europe is upset that it's not the center of attention. This is a pretty good preliminary discussion. There's not going to be a peace agreement coming out of this. And I think the issue here is that there was a real failure in American diplomacy during the Biden administration, and that there was very little talk between the Russians and the Americans. And I think that made the world and Europe less safe.
Mm. I mean, I guess for whatever reason that they have decided to have this meeting at very short order, and it may well be in part to discuss a potential European peacekeeping operation, and may, as Andrew Harding was suggesting, to talk about maybe a change in the balance of the transatlantic security relationship. I mean, in terms of those peace negotiations that are now, we're told, about to get underway between Russia and the US over Ukraine, do you think it's appropriate for the US to negotiate directly with Russia without Ukraine at the table in the first instance?
Well, we negotiate with Ukraine without Russia at the table. We've met with representatives from both countries. Why would this be any different?
As far as Ukraine is concerned, it's because they, I think, and we'll hear it later in the program, but they fear that they are being cut out of a peace process which already seems to have begun with the US offering Russia a whole series of its talking points in terms of not getting back territory that Russia seized, curbing Ukraine's ambitions to join NATO, allowing Russia back into the family of nations in terms of the G8, reciprocal meetings with Donald Trump. I mean, in the words of our Russia editor in Moscow today, the Russian media, state media, are ecstatic.
Well, the Russians and the Russian media like to cause trouble. But again, we've had meetings with Zelensky, so I don't think that there should be such an issue. But I understand Zelensky's position. This has been a horrible war. And the Russians are responsible for it. And if I was Zelensky, I would want to be present at these meetings also. I don't think the U.S. has offered any significant concessions to Russia. The only thing that keeps coming up over and over again is ruling out possible NATO membership for Ukraine in a peace agreement. And I think the official U.S. position right now is that we haven't taken a position on it. But realistically, there's no way to add Ukraine to NATO for the foreseeable future because it would require a unanimous vote of NATO members. That vote isn't there. So, you know, European leaders and Ukrainian leaders can keep talking about that, but they're sort of wasting time. I think more helpful is to try to talk about the structure of a peacekeeping force. And I give the British Prime Minister credit for offering to send British troops if that's acceptable to both parties. That would be a huge sacrifice by Britain to help bring about peace in Ukraine. And I think it could help stabilize and offer as a security assurance so a ceasefire is honored by Russia after it's implemented.
Fred Flights, former deputy assistant to President Trump and also his former chief of staff of the National Security Council. François Esbourg is a senior fellow for Europe at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Paris. What did he make of Fred Flights' view that Europe is essentially panicking over nothing, because the US is simply trying to bring to an end a rather ruinous war.
I think the person who best described the situation in Munich, where I've just been, was the Czech president, who said that the situation rather reminded him of another meeting in Munich, which took place in 1938. I would add, for those who would have forgotten their history lessons, that that was a very effective and speedy negotiation in which the Germans, the Italians, the British, and the French decided together how to bring a peaceful resolution to a dispute between Czechoslovakia and Germany. We all know that that didn't go terribly well, and to negotiate to put Ukraine on the menu rather than at the table along the lines of 1938 is, how to put it, rather revolting.
Yeah, well, I mean,
Sorry, this is not about process. And this is about the future of a country, for Christ's sake.
Understood. I mean, you will be aware that some people say that this sort of comparison with Munich in 1938 and the run-up to World War II is a bit overblown. But nonetheless, you know, even if you say Ukraine is in danger of being sold out here, the question is, what can Europe do about it? And it feels, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels as if Europe can't do that much about it other than to say, well, if there is to be a peace deal and it needs policing, we will do our part.
We don't know what will happen at the summit in Paris this evening. There will probably be some sort of show of hands as to who would be ready to contribute forces to Ukraine in the framework of a security guarantee. Britain is one of them. A number of other countries have also expressed themselves on this, and others yet will probably do so before the evening's over. The question for Europe, including Britain, is whether we are ready and able to provide the weaponry to Ukraine, which it requires if it considers that a meeting in Saudi Arabia between Russia and the United States will not be seen as a satisfactory outcome for the war, and whether the Europeans will be ready if there is eventually maybe some sort of acceptable ceasefire, acceptable to Ukraine, of course, not simply to Russia and Mr. Trump, that ceasefire may be guaranteed, upheld, whatever the words, by a combat force from the European members of NATO.
That is what
is going to be at stake this evening. And just on the parallel with 1938, Mr. Chamberlain had a very clear understanding of how bad the Nazis actually were. It didn't prevent him from doing a rotten deal. But the comparison between this Munich and the previous Munich is rather more advantageous to Mr. Chamberlain than to Mr. Trump at this stage.
François Esbourg speaking to me from Paris. This is NewsHour. And coming up in the programme, the US Secretary of State has met his Saudi counterpart to push the Trump administration's much-criticised vision for the future of Gaza. We'll be hearing about life in Gaza from the point of view of a child.
My name is Abdullah. I'm 13 years old. I'm stuck here in Gaza.
Today I'm revisiting Khan Yunis camp. This area used to be colorful. Now it's gray, just gray.
I was in the best school in Gaza, the British school in the north. All my lessons were in English. Now I'm living in a tent.
That remarkable 13-year-old boy, Abdullah. You'll hear more from him and some other kids in Gaza in about 15 minutes. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. It is one of the most secret and, in its way, consequential meetings on Earth. The conclave to elect the new Pope, when cardinals gather behind very closed doors of the Vatican to elect the man who will lead the world's billion-plus Roman Catholics. And last night in London, a movie called Conclave won four awards at the BAFTAs, including Best Film.
We're about to choose the most famous man in the world.
And 1.25 billion souls watching.
I'd say this is a pretty fair vision of hell.
Well, don't be blasphemous, Ray. Hell arrives tomorrow when we bring in the cardinals.
Well, the film was based on a novel by Robert Harris, and he's been speaking about its genesis with the BBC's Simon Jack.
I was writing another book at the time when the present Pope was elected, and you appear on the balcony to reveal who the new Pope is to the world, and the windows just before the appearance on the balcony fill with the faces of the cardinal electors. Mm-hmm. And I saw all these crafty, sly, elderly, benign faces, and I thought, my God, look, that's the Roman Senate. That's what it would have looked like. And then I thought, there must be some politics behind this. So I started researching it, and sure enough, there was. That election in particular was the model for the one in the novel and the film.
OK, so this was actually based on tidbits and stuff, yeah, of research you'd done. So there is that kind of intrigue and backstabbing that goes on.
Yes, I mean, politics is my great interest. Mm-hmm. And there was a wonderful book published in the 50s called The Masters by C.P. Snow. And it was all about the election of a master in a Cambridge college in the 1930s. And I thought that whole power dynamic of colleagues who know one another in a sort of enclosed institution, how it would work, how it would play out. Was this a way of universalising politics in a way? That's what drew me to it. And then there's the marvellous ritual of the church, and the fact that this is an election for God's representative on earth.
Yep. Only makes stakes are high.
Yeah, and the great thing for any dramatist or novelist is if all the dialogue, nobody's ever saying quite what they mean. Right. It's all sort of slightly aimed off. So everyone has to say they have no personal ambition. Obviously, they hope the chalice passes, yeah, to someone else. And, you know, the Sistine Chapel was built for the election of a pope. I mean, that's what it's there for. And it's the way that they're locked in. So you've also got a slight Agatha Christie locked room dynamic.
Given the fact you've had a few turned into films, do you actually now start writing the book where you think, oh, this would make a great scene, I can imagine this on the big screen?
No, I don't. I think that would be fatal. And actually, it's a pretty long shot that anyone would ever have made Conclave, if you think about it. It's 118 elderly men. I mean, one thing it definitely wasn't up for last night was Best Actress, because there's only a small supporting part.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's pretty diverse. Everyone's from all over the world. But
the voting process is quite tedious by modern standards.
Yes, but this is great. You see, there's a vote and then it resets. There's a vote and then it resets, and everyone thinks, "Oh, that's boring, isn't it?" But it's not. There's a dramatic device. They all come back and do it again. And now a front runner is being squeezed out, because the moment you get a front runner, everyone, of course, wants to pull them down or block them.
Robert Harris, the man who wrote the novel Conclave, it's been turned into a film, and a very good film, I have to say. He was speaking to the BBC's Simon Jack. With less than a week to go until Germany's national election, migration has become the dominant topic. 10 years ago, at the height of Europe's migration crisis, the BBC visited Oberhausen in West Germany to find out how the area was coping. A decade on, we've gone back and attitudes have shifted, as our Berlin correspondent Jess Parker has been finding out.
I'm at the home of Alia and her 10-year-old son, Rami.
We'll take our shoes off. Thank you so much.
They live in a one-bed apartment in West Germany.
I'm so happy to came here to Germany.
This is the sound of a report from 10 years ago when the BBC first met them at a refugee centre in the city of Oberhausen. They'd fled war-torn Syria when Rami was just a baby.
Oh, thanks God that we are in our home. Thanks God that we are safe.
Since then, Alia's learned German and is grateful to her adopted country, but believes some migrants have integrated more than others.
For 10 years, it was very welcoming. But after more problems, the people said, oh, Ausländer raus.
Foreigners out.
Yes. That was really sad for me, because we are not actually bad, because we don't want to live in this situation also.
We just got into Oberhausen, it's a Saturday lunchtime, and we stumbled into a demonstration pretty much on arrival. It's a demonstration against the far-right party Alternative für Deutschland.
I want that my country wants people to get here if they are in trouble.
Piers at the demo with friends and family.
And that we are not doing the border controls. It doesn't make sense.
That's what you want, to keep a generous asylum policy. Do you think that is where Germany is going to end up in the next few years?
I don't think so.
There is so much tension now around immigration.
Yeah.
Do you therefore think some mistakes have been made in the way successive governments have handled this issue?
Maybe yes. Maybe they didn't thought about the things enough. They said, yeah, we will do it.
We'll manage, we'll make it. Angela Merkel.
Yeah, she said it.
Wir haben so vieles geschafft, wir schaffen das. Wir schaffen
das. I think her heart meant the right way. Maybe they should have discovered it out before and said something.
Some breaking news that's coming into us from Germany. A vehicle has been driven into a group of people in Munich.
A string of fatal attacks involving suspects who've been asylum seekers has intensified Germany's fraught migration debate. 66-year-old Georg has lived in Oberhausen most of his life. I meet him strolling near the local park. Does he now want tougher border controls?
It's hard. There has to be security, no matter who's in charge. Not like it is right now. It has to change.
A heated argument breaks out at a campaign stand for the AfD party. Between two men of colour and a local AfD activist, Jörg Langer. We heard you tell him to go back to his own country.
Yeah.
I mean, he grew up here. That is clear racism, no?
No,
that's not racism.
How is it not? I
mean, he personally attacked me. He said, you're a Nazi. And then, of course, you have to say, if something doesn't suit you here in Germany, then you can go back. Then leave us alone here.
Dann lass uns doch dann hier in Ruhe.
I catch up with the two men involved in the argument, Kwame and Pratep.
He told us to go back.
Go back is like three streets away from here.
Like, where should we go back?
That's my phone store over there.
We grew up over here. We've done everything. We have kids here.
In Germany, yes. Do you see the attitudes have changed?
Yeah.
The last four or five years, yeah. Like, it's immigration. Immigrant, that's it.
Yeah.
It's not, oh, what are you doing here? How are you doing? No. Oh, there's one black guy. Oh, there's one from India. Oh,
you know,
there's one from China. What is he doing in Germany? What is he doing in Oberhausen?
Will you come and have Rami? A wash?
It's okay.
Arzt, Fußballer, Polizistkenner.
Back at home with Alia and Rami, a boy who's the same age as Europe's migration crisis. He dreams of being a doctor, footballer, or policeman. As he decides his future, so does Germany.
That was Jess Parker reporting from Oberhausen. We're going to have plenty more reporting from Nizar's James Kamarasamy in the run-up to and then the aftermath of the German election. You're listening to Nizar.
Hello, this is Valerie Sanderson from the Global News Podcast. We're bringing you the latest on talks in Paris to discuss European security and an end to fighting in Ukraine. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. There's been a big advance by Rwandan-backed rebels in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Over the weekend, M23 fighters seized Bukavu, the second city in the region. We managed to get through to one resident of the city. He asked that we not disclose his identity, but he was willing to tell us what the situation is like right now.
At my window, I can say that the security situation is somehow traumatic. But for the moment, people... The situation is now calm. People are no longer frightened by the presence of the rebels because they can now move. They can now move out, try to get some water, and even get some food from the market, from small markets around the roads.
So there's no fighting at the moment?
For the moment, there is no longer fighting.
And in terms of contact with the rebels, I mean, I don't know if you've had any experience of coming across the fighters, or you know people who have, but can you give me a sense of what it's like on the streets?
Before the arrival of the rebels, I mean, on Friday, there was fighting between some gunmen and the National Army, and there was some kind of looting. So many shops, stores, warehouses have been vandalized. But shortly after, I mean, on Saturday, the situation tried to be calm. Early yesterday on morning, the rebel came and they tried to maintain the situation. For the moment, really nothing is to complain. The situation is somehow calm because these rebels are trying to maintain the security of the citizens. They have already allowed people to be moving out so that they can get something to eat in order to avoid starving from hunger.
Have you heard anything from the rebels or from the people who speak for them about what their plans are? I mean, have they addressed the people of Bukavu?
These rebels, we don't know what is their final goal, because people are still really fearing it. They're still really scared with their presence in the city, because we don't know how they will continue living with us down here. We don't know if they want to be really aggressive the way they have aggressed people down in Goma. We are still waiting, we are still observing them, but they seem to be charmed, they seem to be welcoming, they seem to be really viable.
Have you got any thoughts about what you think should happen? I mean, can you think about what you would like to happen as far as the government in Kinshasa is concerned, or maybe even internationally? Do you have thoughts about what should happen?
People want to live in security. They want to live in peace. But we don't know if the National Army want revenge against these rebels. Because these rebels, as soon as they took control of this city, they said they are not here to kill people, but they said they are here to maintain security, to protect people, to try to reorganize the system, and if possible, try to help people lead a better life.
One of the residents of Bukavu in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo now under the control of M23 rebels backed by Rwanda. You're with the BBC and live from London. This is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. You've heard it from us many, many times over the last 16 months that we, along with other international media, have not been allowed access to Gaza, other than occasionally under very limited conditions with the Israeli army. And so it's always a challenge to try to get a sense of what living in that embattled, devastated enclave is like. To that end, a new BBC documentary has spent the last 9 months following the lives of four young people in Gaza as they try to survive the Israel-Hamas war and as they hope for a lasting ceasefire. The filmmakers remotely directed two cameramen on the ground to tell the children's stories. Today, we meet Renad, a 10-year-old food blogger who dreams of being a chef, and the film's narrator, an astonishing 13-year-old called Abdullah.
My name is Abdullah. I'm 13 years old. I'm stuck here in Gaza.
Today I'm revisiting Khan Yunis camp. This area used to be colorful. Now it's gray, just gray.
Among the rubble, I find what's left of my grandfather's house.
What?
Everything's changed since the war started. I was in the best school in Gaza. The British school in the north. All my lessons were in English. Now I'm living in a tent.
On my way back, I find a crowd of people fleeing the eastern areas of Khan Yunis.
When the Israeli army call an evacuation order, you have to leave fast, or it can be deadly.
They have killed our children, killed our women, while Sinwar is hiding underground. Hamas is shooting back.
You have to find something to distract you from the constant pressure of this war.
During the war, there's no school, no place for us to play, so I upload videos and talk to my followers.
Renat's 10. She started an online cooking show with her sister. They're lucky enough to still live in their own home
and film her videos on the roof. While they film, there's an interruption as bombs fall nearby.
We're not afraid anymore. We're used to it. Even in the middle of the night, I'm not scared.
My family moved south to be in the safe zone. But last night, close to my place, the Israeli army hit the camp with huge bombs. 19 people were killed. I've come to see the damage.
This camp was filled with tents. They got buried underground. Oh my God.
How many missiles did they fire? Four? No, it was six. They said there was a secret room for Hamas. We live here. There are no Hamas leaders in this area. Even for one or two, is it right to kill so many people?
Every day there are more evacuation orders. We mainly get these by phone, texts, and social media.
Urgent message. You are required to evacuate the designated humanitarian zone. The Israel Defense Forces will be conducting full-scale operations against terrorist organizations.
Renat's family are preparing in case they need to leave fast. In the end, Renat was able to stay in her house. And now, she has reached 1 million followers. But bombs are still dropping in the safe zone.
We were just sitting here when a bombing suddenly went up. The blast was so loud and there's gunfire too. We were all so frightened right now.
The war seems like it's been going on forever. Then there's an announcement. Renat's gone to watch at a cafe with her brother.
Now I have hope.
The ceasefire is starting. People are going to see what's left of their homes. My house was completely destroyed, so my family have found an apartment. It's damaged, but it's better than the tents. And I just turned 14.
I got old. I'm getting old, actually. My mustache is growing.
My greatest hope is that the ceasefire continues and Gaza goes back to what it was before, or even better. But my biggest fear is that the war will return.
That extraordinary teenager, Abdullah, narrating report, which was taken from the new BBC documentary, Gaza, How to Survive a War Zone. As for the immediate prospects for Gaza, with the need to agree the second stage of the ceasefire, a full hostage release accompanied by a large release of Palestinian prisoners and a full Israeli troop pullout from Gaza. Well, that's being discussed today in Israel by the Security Cabinet. And it's also being discussed in Saudi Arabia by the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who's talking to Saudi officials about, among other things, President Trump's insistence that the more than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza should move out in order that the war-ravaged enclave can be rebuilt, a proposal which for many around the world is seen as wildly impractical and almost certainly illegal under international law. So what, if anything, can Arab states do to influence events, especially as Mr. Trump wants Jordan and Egypt to house those emigre Gazans? We'll hear from a former Prime Minister of Jordan in just a moment. But first, our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman is travelling with Mr. Rubio, and from Riyadh, he gave us this assessment of the American approach.
This plan is in a way intended to put pressure on the Arab nations, particularly under the sponsorship of Saudi Arabia, to come up with something else, in effect a counter-proposal. Now we know certainly that the Egyptians, the Jordanians have been involved in that, and there will be a meeting by Arab leaders here in Saudi Arabia before the end of the month, to effectively put forward an alternative plan to President Trump's. Now, Mr. Rubio, I think, believes that it is up to the Arab nations to basically stump up their support. That would probably mean money, perhaps security forces for Gaza. But what all of this talks to is two things. It is the way that the Palestinian Authority has been effectively sidelined when it comes to the near term of Gaza's future, but also the vacuum of any viable internationally backed future for Gaza now, given that what have been the Biden proposals for the day after, the so-called day after the war in Gaza, all of that's been blown out of the water now, and we have much more uncertainty about what would happen.
Tom Bateman in Riyadh with Marco Rubio. So given the apparently total opposition of Arab states to President Trump's plan somehow to clear out Gaza of its population, can those Arab states offer a compelling alternative plan? Bishr al-Hassani was Jordanian Prime Minister between 2020 and last year. What's his view?
There are Arab ideas that are currently being discussed, and they do not entail the movement of any persons outside the Gaza Strip. This entails a lot of proposals pertaining to the management of the Gaza Strip, but in a context that has to see not only management, but a broader bundle that takes us back into a political horizon that leads to closure on the front of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and in a manner that's predicated on the two-state solution, which was the course of action that was charted by the Madrid process in 1991.
Understood. Forgive me for interrupting. I was just wondering, just in terms of the management of Gaza in the short to medium term, can you put any flesh on the bones there for me?
The Arabs are collectively subscribed to a longer-term vision that does entail a management approach the day after. And that management approach could be one that sees a nonpartisan entity that's agreed upon managing affairs, but that has to be in the context of a longer-term vision that entails a clear and irreversible political horizon that leads to closure on the front of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and that is based on the two-state solution.
If you're talking about a technocratic government then for Gaza, or some sort of administration for Gaza,
a transitional non-partisan entity. Maybe.
Okay, well, so non-partisan, so that means, obviously, by definition, it would mean nobody who's affiliated with Hamas, who have been running the Gaza Strip, and it also suggests no one from Fatah, which dominates the Palestinian Authority. Is that correct?
In the context of particularly the Palestinian Authority, this is the legitimate Palestinian entity that is the product of a discourse that has lasted for the past 30 years. It has been systematically eroded as a partner by successive Israeli governments, but inevitably the Palestinian Authority, being the legitimate representative of the Palestinians, will have to play that fundamental role eventually in that longer-term plan, and it will inevitably have a certain say.
Okay. So you've sketched out the possibility of some sort of, as you put it, non-partisan transitional administration. I guess Israel may well ask the question, even if it were to buy into your vision, what security guarantees can you give us? What security guarantees are you willing to take, you partner Arab countries, willing to take up in order to ensure that you know there won't be trouble in the future?
Tim, if this does not lock in an Israeli commitment to a political horizon that's irreversible in the direction of a clear-cut political commitment, nobody will be willing to partake in committing troops or boots on the ground or any aspect if it is confined to the management era of that longer-term vision. And the lack of the political horizon is fundamentally what has led to several episodes of the outbreak of hostilities and tensions in Gaza repeatedly.
Do you think that one thing that Donald Trump has done has been, in a sense, to galvanize the parties of, I mean, for example, the Arab countries, the Arab League now, to come up with some sort of compelling alternative idea for how the terrible events in Gaza, how we can move on from that? That, in a sense, Trump's got people talking in a way that they haven't had to confront for some time.
Certainly, Tim. We believe that us in Jordan and the Arabs at large can clearly work very constructively with President Trump and with the administration to really usher in and bring closure to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the Arab-Israeli conflict. We don't see eye to eye at all on the front of moving populations out of Gaza. We clearly see that this is not something that can in any manner, fashion or way bring about a solution But we still strongly feel that we can constructively work with President Trump and with the administration to bring about a leap forward and maybe finally a closure and to cross the finish line in the context of materializing a two-state solution that brings in an era of genuine peace and security to all of the countries of the region, including Israel, and that fundamentally also brings closure by finally addressing the long-standing grievance of the Palestinians of not having their own independent state as other populations in the region have.
The former Jordanian Prime Minister Bishar al-Hassouane. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks, and let's head back to our top story now, the emergency summit of European leaders on Ukraine, which is just getting underway in Paris. Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsadze is a Member of Parliament for Ukraine with the opposition European Solidarity Party and joins us live now. Ivana, good to have you back on NewsHour. I'm sure that you and many other Ukrainian members of parliament would like to have a seat at this negotiating table. What do you think Ukraine can now do to influence events diplomatically?
Well, I think first and foremost, we are to continue our fight because it is the fight for sovereignty, for choice, for ability to formulate our future, and counting and working very closely with all the partners. So it is about internal remobilization, I mean, morally, psychologically, militarily, economically, and so on, but also working very, very actively on actions. And that's the silver lining for that, not on words or statements, with all the partners who are willing to invest in their own future, in their own security, that is in Europe, but also together with Europeans, with the American colleagues. I'm sure that there are voices inside the US, and there are those who understand what is at stake and how their national security is dependent also on what is happening at our
We had a former senior Trump official on the program saying, look, everybody should calm down a bit because it's not as if a peace deal is going to be hatched out today between the Russians and the Americans in Saudi Arabia. But it's good that the Americans are talking to the Russians and trying to bring this terrible war to a conclusion. And there are lots of contacts with the Ukrainians. So just everybody should stop being so hysterical. Does he have a point?
You know, I think we all worked together so seriously to make sure that we are isolating the tyrants and terrorists and are not giving them a say in the an upper hand in the international politics. But right now, by re-legitimizing this context and direct conversation with a Russian tyrant, it's going to be much more difficult to actually pressure him to agree to a real, serious, and lasting peace settlement. So I think communication lines and are important. Nevertheless, when they are happening above the heads of all those who have been fighting, who have been standing up to the bully, that is worrisome.
President Trump said that he would expect, before any peace deal is signed, for there to be elections in Ukraine. He also pointed to President Zelensky's opinion poll numbers, which he said aren't that great. You're a member of the opposition. Would you welcome early elections in Ukraine?
You know, as an opposition representative, I would love to see the change in the Ukrainian authorities and ruling party, and also, you know, on the top of our governance. But it is legally impossible, security-wise impossible, organizational-wise impossible to hold the elections. That would be also even resembling free and fair elections as the country is moving towards its European membership and hopefully at some point also to NATO membership. So I don't see how this is happening. I don't see how we can pull this together if we are talking about not a peace settlement and after that elections, but a ceasefire. We have the history of Russia violating up to 20 ceasefires between 2014 and 2022, and what will guarantee that they will not do it once again? And any elections, you know very well, are torn the country apart because it is about competition. It is about well, political rivalry to an extent as well. But that's not what country can allow itself to happen during the war.
Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsadze, Ukrainian Member of Parliament, thank you very much for joining us. The Vatican has said that Pope Francis is being treated for a complex clinical situation and that he now has what they termed a polymicrobial infection, that he will remain in hospital as a result for as long as necessary. The 88-year-old was admitted to Rome's Gemelli Hospital on Friday with symptoms of bronchitis. Our correspondent Bethany Bell is in Rome. What more does she know?
Well, we've had this statement from the Vatican saying that doctors have changed the treatment they were giving the Pope for his respiratory tract infection, and they were doing this to tackle that complex clinical situation. They've also said that he'll stay in hospital for as long as necessary. We've also heard from the Vatican spokesman, Matteo Bruni, saying that Pope Francis is in good spirits. And yesterday, he's been in hospital now since Friday. He was admitted after having had symptoms of bronchitis for several days. And he was taken to hospital. And yesterday, in a post on social media, he thanked the faithful for their prayers and affection. But he wasn't able to deliver his regular Sunday Angelus prayer, which he usually gives to pilgrims, because doctors had ordered complete rest.
Right. But no further detail on what these multiple infections are.
No, we just have this statement from the Vatican saying that doctors have changed the treatment, that he is in a complex clinical situation. We know that engagements for the next few days for the Pope have been cancelled. He's expected to remain in hospital now for as long as he takes. He is 88 years old. He has had influenza several times in the past 2 years. And also, when he was a young man, he had pleurisy, which means he had part of a lung removed. So doctors are watching him very carefully in Rome's Gemelli Hospital, which has a suite which is used for treating the popes.
Mm. And I suppose, I mean, inevitably with these sorts of situations, you know, firstly, doctors have to respect a certain level of medical confidentiality with somebody who is as fabulously important and famous as the pontiff. But there's also, because he's fabulously famous and important, there's also a huge desire to be appraised of any updates. It's a balance for them and the Vatican to strike.
It's a complicated picture always in terms of how much information is given out at what times. And, we were told over the weekend that his condition was stable, it seems. If one is to interpret this statement, that the treatment they were given was not working, so they've had to modify that. So, but yes, we have what the Vatican has said at the moment, and there are many pilgrims in Rome praying at the moment for his health, people saying that they really hope that he will get better very soon.
And that was the BBC's Bethany Bell giving us the latest from Rome. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
Hello, this is Valerie Sanderson from the Global News Podcast. We're bringing you the latest on talks in Paris to discuss European security and an end to fighting in Ukraine. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.